Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Governor Charlie Baker's plan to give local police the authority to work with the feds to hold suspects facing deportation. Civil libertarians call it constitutionally suspect.
By saying I'm only going to take away the constitutional rights of people that we deem dangerous, it somehow makes it seem that it's constitutional or acceptable, and that's simply not true.
The federal crackdown on immigration sparks a constitutional debate in Massachusetts. Also today, car-free neighborhoods in Boston. If it works in Europe, why not here? Plus, a new novel by Boston's Tom Perata takes on divorce, political correctness, the empty nest, and internet porn.
Porn is just an enormous part of our culture, and I wanted to treat it that way in this book.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with a growing debate here in Massachusetts sparked by the federal crackdown on illegal immigration and about the powers of local law enforcement to participate in that crackdown. Last week, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled that state and local officials lack the authority to detain individuals solely on a request from federal immigration authorities. So today, as promised, Massachusetts Governor Baker filed a bill to provide that authority. If approved, it would allow state and local police to cooperate with so-called detainer requests from U.S. immigration officials. These are basically requests to hold people facing deportation orders. The governor says his law would allow police and trial courts to cooperate with ICE to ensure they could hold violent and dangerous criminals to keep Massachusetts communities safe. Opponents of Baker's bill say it would deny due process to those being held. We have two views on this. First, Massachusetts State Representative Jim Lyons from Andover. Representative Lyons has filed his own legislation to give local law enforcement authority to comply with the ICE requests, and he joins us now. Representative Lyons, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Also with us, Executive Director of the ACLU of Massachusetts, Carol Rose. Carol Rose, good to have you as well.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Let me start with you, Representative Lyons. You favor what the governor is trying to do here. Why is a bill like this that gives local law enforcement and the courts the authority to work with ICE a good idea?
Well, first of all, the SJC basically invited the legislature to step into this issue in their latest court ruling. And that's exactly why we did it. As you just pointed out, the according to Massachusetts general laws, as determined by the SJC, there's no statutory authority for them, for our local law enforcement officers to cooperate with ICE.
Right. So no statutory authority. This bill, in theory, would do that. But why is it a good idea? Why is it important to have local law enforcement participating with ICE in this way?
Well, I think it's just simply common sense. What we have is a federal agency who is trying to protect and keep our community safe, and it makes total sense to have cooperation between the federal government and our state government. Just to give you a simple example of cooperation among states, I mean, if you were to get a speeding ticket up in Maine and you didn't pay the speeding ticket, you wouldn't be able to register your license in Massachusetts. That's cooperation between states. So to have the fact that we have legislation in place that allows local authorities to cooperate with federal authorities is nothing more than common sense.
All right. Carol Rose, let me come to you because I know you have concerns that have to do with constitutional rights of those being detained. What are your concerns about a law like this?
Right. Well, I mean, the Supreme Judicial Court issued a very historic ruling that basically said and confirmed what the Department of Justice and the state said, that holding someone, once they've done their time and they're released and they're not a danger to society, holding them any further is an arrest. And when you arrest somebody or detain somebody, that invokes constitutional due process protections. So this bill is really constitutionally suspect because it basically attempts to authorize warrantless detention. And the court did not say that that would be okay. And in fact, it would be unconstitutional. You can't arrest somebody and hold them if you're not holding them on a criminal warrant, which this if they were dangerous, you could hold them. These are people who've already served their time and have been released. You can't hold someone any beyond the time that they served their crime, the time that they've served, just because you don't like them. And that doesn't keep us safe.
Either. So Representative Lyons responded to Carol Rose's concern that this is essentially tantamount to warrantless arrest.
Well, first of all, that's not what the Supreme Court decided. I mean, the issue that the Supreme Court addressed was whether or not there was statutory authority within the Massachusetts general law. As a matter of fact, they went through a number of amicus briefs and said no one even brought that issue up. So therefore, it appears that they did their own research. So the fact of the matter is that we have an obligation as legislators to react, and what we're doing is reacting. And our number one goal, and the goal, I think, of the governor's legislation, is simply to protect our citizens.
But how does it do that? I mean, respond to Carol Rose's concern that essentially we're arresting people who have already served their time who don't pose a threat.
Well, we have, it's called what the issue that was before the SJC was a federal immigration detainer. And what we're suggesting in our legislation is that if there is a federal immigration detainer against an individual, local law enforcement can cooperate with the federal government.
Right.
It's nothing more than that. I mean, the fact that they want to make it more than that, that's up to them. This is a simple issue of cooperating with the federal government.
And Carol Rose, let me ask you, because if you the governor put out a statement, he tweeted about this today, and he said his proposal would keep communities safe from murderers and rapists. So we're talking about people who are suspected of representing a serious risk to communities. Or are you worried that it could go much farther than that?
Well, let me say, first of all, the court did, in fact, rule, and I'll quote from the court's decision from last week, the Supreme Judicial Court, quote, "It is undisputed in this case that holding someone in circumstances like this against his or her will constitutes an arrest under Massachusetts law." So, in fact, we're not talking about just cooperation. There are lots of ways that law enforcement can and does cooperate with Customs and Immigration Enforcement, but holding someone without due process actually is unconstitutional. So we're only objecting to this notion of holding someone without due process. And the other reason that it's a problem, first of all, so it violates people's fundamental civil rights and the Constitution. So that's wrong and unpatriotic on its face. But it also doesn't keep us safe. And there's two reasons it doesn't. First of all, they're not holding people who are suspected of a crime. They're holding people who've already been convicted and served their time. Okay? So we're not talking about people who are, if they're suspected of having committed a crime, they can hold them. That would be a criminal warrant, not an immigration warrant, okay? So this is strictly for people who've already been released from prison. You can't hold them longer. You could, however, the local law enforcement can and does, in fact, contact ICE and say, well, you know, so-and-so is about to get out in a week or 10 days or 3 days. If you want to come get him, you can. That's not a problem. So it doesn't prevent cooperation. What you cannot do is hold someone in detention, under arrest, without any evidence or suspicion that they're about to commit a crime or have committed a crime for which they already haven't served their time. Hmm. So this is just a pure constitutional argument. But on the public safety point, it's important for your listeners to understand that one of the reasons that it's important the local and state law enforcement doesn't be seen as somehow holding people and arresting people on behalf of Federal Customs Immigration Enforcement is that it frightens people so much. And so people refuse to come forward if they've been witnesses to a crime or if they've been victims of a crime because they begin to see the local and state police are one and the same as Trump's ICE deportation officers.
And let me turn that
to distinguish that.
Yeah, I want to turn that argument
safe in their communities.
I got it, Carol Rose. I want to turn that concern to Representative Jim Lyons. And we hear this a lot from folks who are advocates for immigrant groups that this is a way of making local law enforcement appear much less friendly to members of these communities. And that is a safety issue. What do you say to that?
So my responsibility as a legislator is to advocate for the citizens of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And clearly, by cooperating with the local federal agency on a federal immigration detainer is common sense, as I said earlier. And I would reject the argument that was made earlier regarding what the court ruled. The court made it crystal clear in page 10, I think it was, of their ruling, that they would leave the decision as to whether or not to give the authority to local enforcement up to the legislature. That's why we filed it. We filed it so we want to make sure that our local law enforcement officers have the necessary tools to protect the public. It's very simple. They want to make it into this big constitutional issue. The fact is, cooperating between agencies is common sense, and we ought to make sure that we protect our communities.
I want to have one more question to you, Carl Rose. Is there a way that this bill could be tweaked in such a way as passing constitutional muster and still allowing local law enforcement officials a way to cooperate with the feds?
Absolutely. I think passage of another bill called the Safe Communities Act would, in fact, address the public safety concerns that the governor has raised, because it would permit local law enforcement to contact ICE in advance of someone being released after they've done their time. And that would be constitutional. In addition, it would prevent us from having sort of religious registries and things like that. So passage of the Safe Communities Act would address both the constitutional concerns that the ACLU and other groups have, and would also address the public safety concerns the governor has raised without being constitutionally suspect the way that this bill that was introduced today is.
All right. Well, we're out of time, but I want to thank you both for talking with us today. Carol Rose is the executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts, and Jim Lyons, state rep from Andover. Thank you both. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And obviously this debate will continue. Stay with us. Coming up, should Greater Boston have more car-free zones in the city? We'll take your calls and talk about it. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And in case you missed it, here in Boston, this is day two of Carmageddon, the traffic apocalypse. We're talking, of course, about the partial shutdown of the Mass Pike and the rebuilding of the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge, which is taking place just blocks from our studio. This morning, Acting Highway Administrator Jonathan Gulliver said overall traffic levels are down about 20% on the Pike. People are finding other ways around it. And he's optimistic that the project will be complete on time in just a couple of weeks.
We hit all our major milestones. We're expecting to hit all our upcoming major milestones. So we're pretty happy with progress right now.
So pretty happy with the progress. Now, for commuters, the road closures and detours have created delays and inconvenience, but they also reminded some of us of the pleasures of a car-free urban center. I've been biking to work this week, loving that the BU Bridge has been transformed from a life-threatening obstacle course to a peaceful oasis spanning the Charles River. It's a delight for bikers and pedestrians. Now, we understand that lots of drivers will be happy to have the bridge back. We need it. But it did make us wonder, why don't we have more car-free zones in and around Boston? And if we did, where would they be? What would they look like? And how would they transform both the city's landscape and our relationship to it? Well, to talk a little bit about that, joining me in the studio is Brian Reamer. He's the Associate Director of the New England University Transportation Center at MIT. Welcome back. Good to have
you. Thank
you. Yeah, thanks for joining us. And joining us by telephone is Randall O'Toole. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in Washington, author of Gridlock, Why We're Stuck in Traffic and What to Do About It. And Randall O'Toole, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. Do you favor more car-free neighborhoods in the city? Some will point out that it works in Europe. Why not here? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Brian, I want to sort of acknowledge, first of all, there are some car-free zones in Boston, like Downtown Crossing, but is there an argument for more, for bigger, for sort of pursuing this agenda more aggressively?
Well, I think it's really a balancing question. And in and of itself, how do we balance our needs for vehicular traveler with that of the pedestrians and the cyclists? I'm a biker by nature, love riding, hate riding down Comm Ave in particular during commuting hours. So how do we begin to move traffic patterns around to allow more space for cyclists? And is the answer car-free, or is it really multi-use where the pedestrians have their zone, the cyclists have their zone, and the cars have their zone? And that's really been a model that's really taken off in Europe, where cycling to and from work is the norm in many cities.
Yeah. So give us an example of how that might work, or, you know, what you would like to see. I mean, are we talking about, I don't know, like Newbury Street, for example, that there's been that experiment, just keep it car-free for good?
Well, that's one option. The other option that I really prefer is how do we take the sidewalk and perhaps some of the shoulders we see it today? You have the cars moving as they do in the center. You bring the parked cars next to them and use the parked cars as a protective barrier to the cyclists and the pedestrians who are sharing the sidewalk and their own walk streams.
Yeah. Well, what about the sort of European example? I'm thinking of historic centers in you know, obviously old cities over there, but Boston is an old city. Why not just shut down parts of the city to daily traffic?
Well, I think that that's a possibility as well, but we do have to begin to think about where do the cars go and how do we move around that zone and how do we redefine the flow, the queuing effect that occurs as we enter intersections and move around that. How do we redefine that to allow for that car-free zone so that we don't end up with increased gridlock on the Mass Pike, Comm Ave, and every other intersection throughout the city?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And that's really doable, but it's going to take a long-term focus and shifting the vehicular traffic around differently. And Bostonians aren't known to be good and looking forward to change, and especially in traffic flow.
Right. Yeah, you could almost say we're famous for just the being just the other way. Listeners, we're talking about whether more car-free zones in the greater Boston area is an idea worth considering. What do you think? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Randall O'Toole, I'd love to get your perspective on this. You're author of a book called Gridlock, Why We're Stuck in Traffic and What to Do About It. Tell us your quick answer to the question. Can cities like Boston just shut down areas to traffic so that pedestrians and bicyclists can have a slightly better quality of life?
Well, roughly 100 cities across the United States have attempted to do so in the past, and roughly 90% of them have ended up reopening their cities, their streets to cars because they essentially destroyed all the businesses because people couldn't get to them by car and they weren't willing to walk more than a block or two to get to them on foot. So the businesses moved away. The few places where pedestrian-free or car-free zones have succeeded tended to be places where the pedestrians were already there in large numbers, such as universities or resort towns. And if you already have lots and lots of pedestrians and you have plenty of parking for people to park at that's near to the car-free zone, then you can close a street or two to cars and still get lots of business for local businesses and still get a thriving neighborhood.
So let me throw two examples. I don't know how well you know the Boston area, but I'm going to assume you know it well enough for this conversation. I mean, a neighborhood like, I don't know, downtown Boston, you know, there's lots of foot traffic, lots of people work down there. There's, you know, all kinds of businesses, financial businesses and so on and so forth. I mean, would that be a part, an example of a downtown area that would do well with no traffic?
I don't think any downtown closures have worked very well. If you closed like one block of one street to cars, you might be able to make it work. But if you start closing more than a street or two and more than a block or two of those streets, then what's going to happen is people are going to respond. You know, people are responding to the closure of the highway right now in Boston. They're responding by changing their travel habits. If that highway were closed permanently, their job locations would move, their home locations would move, because they would want to avoid the congestion.
But let me ask you this. Here's what I'm really...
Too many streets as businesses would move out of downtown.
And I hear that argument, but I'm really puzzled by this. When I was a kid, I was growing up in Europe, and I remember this debate happening in Italy in the 1970s. And the predictions were that downtown businesses, city center businesses, were going to all suffer when they started to close those historic centers of the cities across Europe. In this case, it was Italy. And those arguments were never borne out. In fact, the businesses thrived. They did better and better. So what's different over there than the model here? Brian, go ahead.
I think it's really the design of the cities in general, because if you think about a lot of the European cities, the dense downtown environments were really developed before the advent of the car. They were designed as pedestrian malls.
Yeah.
The cars came afterward. Here in cities such as Boston, New York, even the West Coast, San Francisco, L.A., we're dealing with cities that really came along after the automotive revolution. So, you know, we can take cars out, as Randall said, of a block or two, but our demand for mobility and our connection to the vehicle as a convenient way from getting from point A to point B really dominates. I think the broader question is, how do we develop more effective shared use environments where, you know, the pedestrians, the cyclists, and the vehicles all can coexist together in a much more conflict-free, stress-free environment?
Well, I want to get to some of your ideas for that, but we've got a lot of people wanting to get on this conversation. So let's take some calls. Josh is calling from East Ham. Josh, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Yeah, thank you. As somebody who has lived both in major metropolitan areas in the United States as well as Newcastle, England, the problem with having car-free zones is we're such an auto-focused culture compared to Europe. Somebody who bikes on the Cape out of necessity because of the traffic down here, the congestion is so bad. Whereas in Europe and Newcastle, England, they're not really that bothered with their autos, so they could care less. I know plenty of people over in England who don't even have a driver's license.
Right. Well, arguably, and Randall O'Toole, maybe you can chime in on this. Isn't that changing? I mean, there does seem to be a sense, particularly among younger Americans, millennials, where there is less interest in cars. Does that portend a sort of kind of change as we go forward and maybe a more openness to car-free zones?
Well, the millennials were maturing just as we had the big financial crisis. And as we recover from that crisis, they're going out and buying cars just like everybody else. Driving is surging upwards now much faster than the population. So per capita driving is increasing. And, you know, when we compare the United States with Europe, we have to remember two things. One is that in Europe, gas taxes, fuel taxes are $4 to $6 a gallon, and that suppresses driving. But the other thing is, even with those high fuel taxes, Europeans drive far more than they do any other form of travel. They drive far more than they use transit or intercity trains or planes or anything else. We drive for about 85% of our travel in the United States. Europeans drive for about 78%. It's less total miles because they drive about 10,000 miles per capita per year, and we drive about 15,000 miles, or rather, we travel 15,000 miles per capita per year. So we do travel more. That's because of our fuel prices.
Sure. Interesting. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Medford. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to say I really appreciate the thought of just looking after people and bikes, not just cars, and the design of things. I've been to L.A., where they have main boulevards that are closed off to road traffic, but foot traffic gets to flow through there, and the shops really feel the benefit of that because people are much more likely to take a minute and see into a shop, look into it, walk into it, you know, if they can actually get there and they're not having to park and they're not having to stop. I'd like to see more of it.
All right. There's Alex from Medford. I'd like to see more of that here in Boston. Brian, you were talking about things that we could do to essentially improve the possibility of coexistence of cars and pedestrian cars and bicycles. It seems like we're seeing some evidence of that around the city. I'd argue not a lot of it, and it's not happening fast. But what more needs to be done to sort of speed it up?
Yeah, and I'd agree. We're seeing more and more of that around the city, and it is not happening fast enough, from downtown Boston and installation of some protected bike lanes to Brookline doing the same thing. I think European cities in general, the ones that are most friendly to pedestrians and cyclists, have really adopted broad multi-use design. The cars are traveling in the roadway, separated from the park car by the parked cars from the pedestrians and the bicyclists. Here in Boston, we have a tendency to run bike lanes next to the moving traffic, where we're all worried about the car door opening or a motorist on our left swerving right. So it's really protecting the cyclists, putting the cyclists and the pedestrians that are moving at a relatively more consistent speed, separating them from the traffic flow, to encourage the use of alternate forms of transportation. Now, that's both transit, areas we need to improve here in the city as well as walking and cycling.
Hmm. What about, is there an argument, Randall O'Toole, I'll come to you for this. I mean, I'm just curious about this, for sort of forcing the issue. In other words, people's, the way people live and the way people would choose to get around might well be dictated by the way the roads exist. As you mentioned, you know, Commonwealth Avenue is closed down. The Mass Pike is closed down today. People have found another way to get around. So if there were laws and policies that essentially, you know, essentially protected urban centers, wouldn't people just adapt? And in the long run, wouldn't that be better for the urban centers?
Well, the way they would adapt is they would move their jobs away from Boston. They would move their homes away from Boston. They would avoid places where they couldn't get around.
I see.
And so that's not a good policy if you want to maintain economic viability. You know, if you don't mind poverty as a result, then that might be okay. You know, just last week I was visiting a city that I think has probably the highest amount of pedestrianism on one particular street of any city in the United States. They have tens of thousands of pedestrians going up and down the sidewalks of this street all day long. And they do it despite the fact that the weather there gets up to be 108 and 110 degrees. And I'm thinking of Las Vegas, and in particular the Las Vegas Strip. Now, the Las Vegas Strip is a street that is 10 lanes wide for automobiles. And the street has sidewalks on both sides with pedestrian overpasses on all major intersections. And so you get this huge amount of pedestrianism because we've separated the pedestrian somewhat from the cars. Personally, I'm a cyclist. I cycled up and down the Las Vegas Strip and other streets there, but most people don't bicycle, but they do walk a lot in the heat. And I think, you know, what Brian is saying is true. It's not a measure of closing the streets to cars. It's a matter of making the streets accommodate both cars and pedestrians and hopefully bicyclists safely.
Well, let me introduce Vineet Gupta. He's a director of policy and planning for the Boston Transportation Department, and he oversees the city's initiative Go Boston 2030. And welcome to Radio Boston, Vineet Gupta. Good to have you.
Happy to join you.
So you've been listening to this conversation. Give us a quick sort of rundown. What are Boston's plans for car-free areas or with regard to what Brian and Randall have been talking about, ways in which roads can be made more accommodating to cars and people?
Sure. Well, let's start with an example that's been around for, I guess, several decades now, downtown crossing. And it's seen various levels of success over the years. And in recent years, there's been a resurgence of more and more use by pedestrians. There's activity on the street. There is more option for shopping. There are more residents living in the area. So the question to ask is, how has it made a resurgence? And I think that there are two major ingredients that might apply to other situations as well throughout Boston or in other cities. One is that we need activity on the street, whether it's vendors, whether it's people performing, whether you can do a free yoga class like you can do out in Downtown Crossing today. That's one. Two, you really need partnerships with the people who live there, people who have small businesses there, people who go to work there. And in this case, in Downtown Crossing, we have the Downtown BID. And they've done a really good job in partnership with the City of Boston to work with all the abutters, work with people who are dependent on the Downtown Crossing area to make it a success.
So, Vineet, are there other parts of the city that might be suitable for that kind of model, that kind of downtown crossing type car-free model?
I think there are opportunities for sure. And one example, or two examples that I can talk about, one is Newbury Street, where, as you know, we have been experimenting at this stage with closing the street on a weekend morning, pretty much. And again, it's been a huge success. The other is Canal Street, mm-hmm. In the Bullfinch Triangle area near North Station, where we again did what we call an open street, but limiting it to pedestrians. The point here is that you can't flick a switch and make an area pedestrianized all the time, kind of at once. it has to be phased in. People have to get used to it. So you start maybe on a weekend morning, and if it's a success, maybe do that more often. So you really have to kind of phase things in.
I get it.
Do them overnight.
Vineet Gupta, stand by because we've got a couple more calls. I'd love to have you on the line for them as well. Sam is calling from Somerville. Sam, good to have you. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you. We're talking about cars as though they're this foregone conclusion that everybody needs, but they're also destroying our planet, and I don't really see how we can have this conversation without talking about climate change and privileging the forms of transportation that aren't contributing to it.
Yeah, it's a good point. Vineet Gupta, let me come to you as sort of the representative voice from the city of Boston. To what extent is climate change being considered in this conversation?
Well, you mentioned that the city has recently launched Go Boston 2030. We published the final plan in March. And as part of that plan, there are some goals that drive it. And those really have to do with reducing the use of motor vehicles in the city and increasing the use of transit, increasing opportunities for people to bike. All of that means that we will have less emissions and that would have a definitive impact on climate change.
Yeah. And Brian Reamer, I'd love to come to you with that question as well. I mean, to what extent should this the climate change issue be driving this conversation?
Well, I think it all drives the conversation. I think congestion, climate change all blend together to some degree. And in really the modernization of an urban infrastructure, and that's transit, pedestrian zones, cyclists, vehicles coexisting. It's not that the car is going to go away. It's not that the car should go away. Maybe different powertrains make more sense. But how do we begin to really modernize our infrastructure over the course of time? As Vineet said, you can't flick a switch overnight. Money here doesn't grow on trees. It's going to take resources. It's going to take planning, and it takes long-term strategy.
We've got time for a couple more calls. Let's go to Joel, who's calling from Hyannis and listening to us down there on the Cape. Joel, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, tell me what's on your mind.
A couple times throughout the summer in Hyannis, there's this program, Hyannis Open Streets, where they close down a portion of Main Street to vehicles. And it's a great time, actually. I mean, I spoke to a lot of the people who own businesses there, and there's a lot more traffic there because there's a lot more people walking. And in communities where this has happened, I've heard of an example in Curitiba in Brazil, where they closed down a section of the street, and at first the business owners were very opposed to it, but in a couple of weeks they saw the increase in business from people and increased foot traffic, and it's been one of the most popular places in the city ever since.
Interesting, Joe. I'm glad you brought that up. Randall O'Toole, I sort of brought up that same argument a little while ago, but what's the secret sauce there? Because clearly it works in some parts of the world and in some cities. Vineet talked about agreements with local businesses, but when does foot traffic only, help businesses as opposed to driving folks away from businesses, as you suggested, also can happen?
Well, as I said, the pedestrianism works when there's already a lot of pedestrians.
I see.
And there's already a lot of pedestrians in Hyannis because it's a resort area, and there's already a lot of pedestrians in Curitiba because automobile ownership is only about half of what it is here. And so, it's going to work there better than it's going to work in an ordinary American city where we have 8 cars for every 10 people. And, we have tried for decades to reduce auto driving. People don't remember, but 50 years ago, our air was filthy. You couldn't see across from one end of the city to another because the air was so dirty. And so we did two things. We made cars cleaner, and we tried to get people out of their cars and onto transit and walking and bicycling. And we made the cars a lot cleaner. Today, the average new car produces only about 2 or 3% of the pollution of what a car did in 1970. On the other hand, our attempts to get people out of their cars failed miserably. We've ended up making our cities more congested, so we've actually made our cities more polluted than they were because cars pollute more in congestion. So if our goal is to reduce global emissions of CO2 or other greenhouse gases, then the way to do it is to make cars greener, not to try to reduce people's driving, because that doesn't work.
Interesting. Brian Reamer, a final thought from you.
I think the answer is people like to drive. People like personal mobility, and that's why, you know, services such as Uber and Lyft are doing so well in the States. But convenient, reliable public transportation does pull cars away from the road. And investing strategically in alternative forms of transportation is a wise choice for cities in the future.
All right. Well, we're going to leave the conversation there, but I want to thank Brian Reamer, Associate Director of the New England University Transportation Center at MIT. Brian, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Randall O'Toole at the Cato Institute, author of Gridlock, Why We're Stuck in Traffic and What to Do About It. Randall, thank you very much.
Happy to be here.
And Vineet Gupta, Director of Policy and Planning for the Boston Transportation Department. Vineet Gupta, thank you as well.
Thanks much.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, author Tom Perata on his new novel, Mrs. Fletcher. He's with us live in the studio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The writer Tom Perata, who lives in Belmont, is a keen observer of life in our modern world, of human frailties and human contradictions. That comes through loud and clear in his latest novel, which tells the story of Eve Fletcher, a 46-year-old divorced mother living alone after her bro-y lacrosse-playing son Brendan leaves for college, mostly to party and to meet girls. Eve is concerned about her son's casual treatment of women, but as an empty nester, she develops a taste for internet porn. Tom Perata is perhaps best known for his novel The Leftovers, which became a hit HBO series and ended its third and final season just this past June. He's also author of Election and Little Children, which were both made into Oscar-nominated movies. His new novel, out today, is called Mrs. Fletcher, and Tom Perata is with us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston. It's great to have you, and it's great to be reading your book. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So I would love to just start with your sort of your description of your main protagonist, Eve Fletcher. What does she represent? Who is she?
You gave a nice setup for the book. Eve is a 46-year-old woman. The one thing she's happy about in her life is she runs a senior center. She feels fulfilled as a professional woman. She is not fulfilled in her personal life, and she is dreading the absence of her son and the kind of loneliness that she foresees when she is really in an empty nest. You know, we talk about the empty nest, but it's one thing if it's a married couple thinking about, okay, who are we when we're not parents? That's one kind of problem. But for Eve, it's like, I need something in my life. And one of the things she does is she goes back to school. So she's in college while her son is in college. She just takes one night class. But she is also actively looking to jumpstart her love life, and she gets a little more than she bargains for.
Right. And I want to talk a little bit about how she gets there. But I'd love you to do a reading from early on in the book, because it sets up a couple of themes that I want to talk to you about. So can you read this short passage? It's right on page 14, and the setup is that Eve finally delivers her son, Brendan, to his dorm room. She has high hopes about this college experience that Brendan is embarking on, including her high hopes as to who his roommate might be.
That's right. Okay, yes. So Eve has to park the car, and when she gets back to the dorm, Brendan is already there with his roommate. The new roommate seemed nice enough, but Eve had to work to conceal her disappointment. She'd hoped that Brendan would get a more exotic roommate, a black kid from inner city Boston, or a visiting student from mainland China, or maybe a gay guy with a passion for musical theater, someone who would expand her son's horizons and challenge him to move beyond his suburban comfort zone. Instead, he'd gotten paired with a young man who could have been his long-lost brother, or at least a teammate on the Haddington High lacrosse team. When she arrived, the boys were admiring their matching mini-fridges. "We could dedicate one to beer," Zach suggested. "The other one could be for non-beer stuff, lunch meat or whatever." "Totally," agreed Brendan. "Milk for cereal." "Arizona's." Zach fingered his puka shells. "Might be cool if we stacked one on top of the other. Then it would be like one medium-sized fridge with two compartments. Give us more floor space that way." "Sweet." Eve went straight to work, putting sheets and blankets on Brendan's bed and organizing his closet and dresser just the way they were at home so he wouldn't be disoriented. Neither boy paid much attention to her. They were strategizing about maybe lofting one of the beds and moving a desk underneath, freeing up enough space for a couch, which would make it easier to play video games. And she told herself that it was completely natural for a mother to be ignored in a situation like this. This was their room and their world. She was an outsider who would soon be on her way.
I love this scene in the dorm room. What's going through her mind? I mean, this is sort of painful for her, given how the sort of hopes and expectations for that day begin.
Right? Yeah, well, so, you know, Eve is very invested in making this a day to remember and a kind of a capstone to this chapter of their lives where Brendan was living at home and he's her son and she's proud of him and has high hopes. But he doesn't follow her script. And in fact, she catches him that morning with his girlfriend. She doesn't catch them visually, but she hears through the door that they're engaged in some sexual activity. And he says some things that strike her as very crude and, you know, bordering on misogynist. And it really troubles her. And she's torn on the ride to college between being a responsible mother and talking to him about respect for women and sticking to this idea that they're going to have a great day. And like a lot of conflict-averse parents, she kind of chickens out.
Yeah.
And
he does her the favor by sort of pulling his hat down over his eyes and says, wake me up when we get there,
yeah,
Mom.
Yeah, he sleeps or pretends to sleep. And so when she sees that, you know, he has this roommate who is just like him, she has this sinking feeling like, oh, he's not going to have the college experience that I hope for him, which is that he'll be changed and challenged and will grow up.
Now, early in the book, Eve gets an anonymous text message. This is after she's dropped Brendan off at college. And it refers to her by a crude acronym that we won't use on the radio, but it means basically a sexually attractive older woman. And this sends her down a really interesting path, which dominates a good deal of the book. So tell us a little bit about this journey, where it takes her.
Yeah, so Eve gets this text, and she's offended, and she's worried that it may have come from one of Brendan's friends, which makes it even creepier. But she actually realizes that she doesn't exactly know what this term means. And she Googles it. And of course, in the process of Googling it, she discovers that there is this sort of gigantic reservoir of pornography, some of which she ends up almost in spite of herself looking at it. And she finds a site that is basically ordinary women sending in their amateur videos. And in a way that surprises her, she's almost flattered. She's like, oh, maybe I am that. And that what that is you know, she's thinking I'm lonely, I'm past my prime, my sexual life may be over. And suddenly this word, this label comes to her and she puts it on. She tries it on because there's nothing else to try on at this moment in her life. And what it does, oddly, is sort of eroticize her world in a strange way, because there are these porn scenarios that she becomes aware of. Suddenly she sees these scenarios offering themselves up in real life, and sometimes she simply fantasizes, and a couple of times she actually tries them out.
It's so interesting. You know, we talk about contradictions and sort of these ironic contradictions that you put together so well. So she's doing that in the evening, and by day she's taking this class at a community college about gender and sexuality taught by a transgender professor, and the whole sort of experience kind of reeks of academic political correctness. So that she's got that going on one part of her life, and then this sort of exploration of porn in the other part of her life.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that's happening is that in this book is that a middle-aged person is, in a sense, navigating the sexual territory that college kids navigate. Meaning, as you say, one of the primary things going on in college right now is that both students and professors are trying to rethink gender, talk about consent, make the world more inclusive, less misogynist, et cetera. So there's a kind of high-minded attempt to restructure the way that the culture thinks about sexuality. And then there's this underworld of porn where all the rejected ideas go and are allowed to roam free, you know. And so I think it's especially confusing for kids because a lot of them are exposed to the porn before they're exposed to the sort of new thinking about gender and sexuality. And so they're kind of caught between two, you know, essentially opposite visions of sexuality. Like, just for instance, you know, one of the things Eve notices in porn is that there's no such thing as sexual harassment. Every time there's a chance for an inappropriate relationship, it will happen. You know, a doctor and a patient, a teacher and a student, a babysitter and a parent. I mean, those things in porn are sexy, and the idea always is that the both parties always want it. You know, and of course, in college, what they're saying is like, consent is a very specific thing and you need to be very aware of it. And so I think contradictory messages are everywhere in our culture right now. That's a, I think, a trademark of American sexuality. We're Puritans and we're libertines.
It's really, really interesting. And you bring this out so well. It's so much fun to read this book. I just can't sort of stress that enough. Because it could have been dark. I mean, I think there are dark moments, but I found myself sort of smiling and laughing about what these folks are dealing with and the ironies that you bring out. I wanted to ask you, too, about your view or the way it's represented in this book. The sort of technology is a kind of a character almost in your book, or at least it's a lens that sort of bends and shapes people's experiences in a big way. And I think of two examples. I mean, one is the obvious Eve sort of stumbling on these porn sites that sort of take her down a rabbit hole. But early in the book, too, she asks her son to be in touch with him and to text him every day. And he does text her. And the first thing he texts her is, "Mom, college is awesome," 3 exclamation points. And the next day it's like, "Mom, college is still awesome." And she imbues so much meaning in that. These are sort of worthless text messages that he rattles off. And yet they mean so much to her. And it just made me think, what are we making of this mode of communication?
Yeah, well, there's so many things to say there, right? Because when I went to college, I had to call long distance home, and my parents were the kind of people who thought long distance calling was something to be done only in an emergency. And so we had very strict protocols for a once a week call. So going to college, I really felt like I was, you know, on my own.
Yeah.
And I do think it's, you know, that sort of independence is very different from what kids may have now, where they're just in constant touch with their parents. Brendan is a little bit more like people of my generation. He doesn't really want to stay in touch with his mom. But the other thing I think really is going on in the book is this sense that every generation has their own experience of sexuality. And this one, it's hugely mediated by technology.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, there's a woman who works for Eve who has a sort of Tinder habit, you know, Brandon's girlfriend sometimes treats him to a little illicit peek, you know, while they're Skyping. That, you know, there's a lot of sexy texting in the book. It feels like this is a book that could not have been written before now. And I think the question always is when we look at these kind of cultural changes, it's like, are people the same and just the technology different, or has technology changed us and made us?
It's a great question. Yeah. What do you think the answer is?
I think it's changed us.
Yeah,
I do. I think I have no idea what it would be like to have access to the entire encyclopedia of human sexuality that you know these porn sites are when you're so young that you don't have any experience. I mean, I think sex was this sort of mystery when I was growing up, and you had to kind of fumble your way through it. And I think now there's just people just have a lot more virtual sexual experience before they have actual sexual experience. And I don't know what that is, but I have a feeling that something new is happening.
Well, something new is happening indeed. And Tom Perotta puts it in a great perspective in his book, Mrs. Fletcher. Tom Barata, best-selling author of 9 books, including The Leftovers, Election, and Little Children. His latest is Mrs. Fletcher, which is out in bookstores today. And he'll be at the Brookline Booksmith tonight at Newtonville Books on August 11th. We have a lot more information on our website at radioboston.org. Tom Barata, thanks so much for coming in. What a pleasure to meet you and talk to you. Appreciate it.
Thanks. It's been fun.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.